This is the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. This is episode 274. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com. Normally, we would have Seth Cox from Avenger the Birds on the show as well. However, this edition of the show, episode 274, happens to be the third and final installment of our season previews, of our opponent previews. In the previous two episodes, in episode 272, we talked to writers from the other NFL Wire sites like CardsWire, and we previewed weeks 1 through 4 with the San Francisco 49ers, the Washington football team, Detroit Lions and Carolina Panthers. And in our last episode, 273, we went through weeks 5 through 8 with the New York Jets, Dallas Cowboys, Seattle Seahawks, and Miami Dolphins. Over the final 8 games of the season, the Cardinals have 5 opponents. How the season goes up is after the bye, they play the Miami Dolphins in week 9 after their bye. Then the second half of the season goes Buffalo Bills, Seattle Seahawks, New England Patriots, LA Rams, New York Giants, Philadelphia Eagles, San Francisco 49ers, and LA Rams. So the Seahawks and the 49ers, we've already previewed those teams as we spoke to Kyle Madsen from NinersWire.com in our first episode of the opponent previews. And in our last show, we talked to Cole Musgrove about the Seahawks. And so we've got 5 opponents. And so what we're going to do in this edition of the show, we've got previews for the Buffalo Bills, New England Patriots, LA Rams, New York Giants, and Philadelphia Eagles. It's a supersized edition, so it'll be a little bit longer because it's 5 teams instead of 4. So let's go ahead and kick things off with the Buffalo Bills. To help us with that, I have from BillsWire.com, it's the USA Today NFL Wire site, like CardsWire, that covers the Buffalo Bills. And I have managing editor Nick Wotan. Nick, how are things going out there?
Surviving, staying safe nowadays. I'm really glad I help out our sister brother site over here, CardsWire. So happy to do it anytime.
Thank you for, as always, thank you for being on. Appreciate the time. So as we get started, kind of what I want to do is kind of go through, okay, the Bills and how they did last season, sort of the big, like the impact losses, the impact gains in free agency and the draft. And go from there. We'll talk about what their outlook is, some of the other off-season stories that there might be, and what your outlook is for the Bills this year, and how you think things might play out when the Cardinals play Buffalo, which is later in the season as you hit the second half of the season. So let's go ahead and start off with how they did last year. Obviously, Buffalo, a playoff team for the first time in a long time. How was last season? What went well? What could have gone better for Buffalo last year? Obviously, things went well as they were in the postseason for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, it was. It's been a complete, I guess, revelation under Buffalo head coach Sean McDermott. I got to give it to him. We had Rex Ryan before that, and everyone nationally knows Rex Ryan can, for lack of a better term, put his foot in his mouth, and he sure, certainly did a lot. And only 2 years into a 5-year deal, they got rid of him. They brought Sean McDermott in. Now they've been to the playoffs, and it was last year was a little bit more looking at it with the upcoming season. It was a little bit of a coin flip on offense, and that's kind of the same thing that's going to be this upcoming year. We'll get there. But on defense, in the last 3 seasons under Sean McDermott, they've been really probably the most overlooked defense in the entire league. I think that has to do with them being in Buffalo, and when you don't have the playoffs for almost 2 decades, you're kind of overlooked. Plus a small market, so it's no one's really going to look at Buffalo as a top 3 defense, but that's exactly what they were. They've been the top 3 defense, I think, 2 out of the 3 seasons that McDermott has been there, and they just kind of keep reloading. They got still a lot of the pieces on that side of the ball, so we'll get there. But last season and this season, really about the exact same guy, Josh Allen. The Bills are going to go where Josh Allen takes them. He took them to the playoffs last year, but the big curveball this year is comparatively, of course, year to year, who knows how every football team is going to be. There seems to be a team that goes worst to first every single season in some division. So last year, the Bills, I think, one of the easiest schedules in the league. This year, I think they have the fifth hardest, tied with maybe the Lions, if I'm remembering correctly. So having said that, playoffs last year, this year is going to be all about, okay, now we got to up that. We got to up the ante. We made the playoffs. Now, let's see. There's no guy named Tom Brady anymore in our backyard. So first time since 1995, maybe the AFC East. We'll see. But last season, again, just getting into the playoffs was big for the Bills. And Josh Allen kind of hurt us all there a little bit in the overtime against the Texans. I don't even know how to explain it. A couple of them, I had all of that ball. It was just kind of that was what everyone remembers in Western New York and nationally. But aside from that, overall, other than that 17th game, I think it was quite a surprise last year for the Bills, and everyone was happy about it, double-digit wins and whatnot.
So let's fast forward a little bit as free agency hits. Who were some of the impact losses? Now, the Cardinals benefited from one of those impact losses in Jordan Phillips joining the team over here after his, honestly, it was a historic season for someone of his size. He set an NFL record for the number of sacks in a season for a guy that weighs at least 340 pounds. When I see that, I hope he can not necessarily replicate that, but at least have that sort of impact, because he's never done that before. Now, who are the impact losses in free agency? How will that affect them? And then, what are the impact gains or additions that were made in the offseason?
A lot of the Bills' offseason was specifically centered on the defensive line, both in regards to losses and gains. Of course, there's that guy, Stephon Diggs. We'll get to him. But in the trenches on defense, the Bills lost, as you mentioned, Jordan Phillips. Really was a revelation. He really, really, and hopefully he brings this to the Cardinals, except in week 10, I'll say that, you know, hopefully not. But he's really a guy who plays super motivated. I mean, he in the second round by the Dolphins, who are the division rival, the Bills. So the Bills picked him up on waivers. He kind of had that. You could kind of tell, like, every single snap he had that in his head, that the Dolphins kind of ran him out of town, and he just played with an edge every single time. He's always pumping up the crowd, and I know it's not something that's you're going to see on the stat sheet, and you hope it does, but that guy's going to give you 1,000%. At least he did with Buffalo. Hopefully he does in Arizona, but he was a key loss. Jordan Phillips actually, you know, this isn't a stat like the I didn't know that 340-pound stat. That was pretty good. But he did so well for the Bills in the beginning of the year that he kept Ed Oliver, the Bills' first-round pick last year, off the field because Jordan Phillips was doing so good that they kept starting him over Ed Oliver. So and of course, in terms of gains, the reason why they kind of let him go was, well, Ed Oliver's a first-round pick. You got that investment in him. He's got that year under him. You know, we got to save some money somewhere. So sorry, Jordan, we got to give it to the first-round pick. But sure, if they could have found a way to keep both of them, the Bills would really wanted to keep Jordan Phillips. And in regards to our other loss, Shaq Lawson, another former first-round pick of the Bills, he was actually the last Rex Ryan draft pick still remaining on the roster, Doug Whaley. Rex Ryan, Doug Whaley was the former GM of the Bills. That's only in 2006. So the Bills' new management came in, kind of totally cleaned house, except Shaq Lawson. He did have a career season, just like Jordan Phillips, 6.5 sacks. You'd like to see more out of Shaq Lawson. But the big key that both the Cardinals and the Dolphins, who signed Shaq Lawson, are hoping for is that the Bills, they run a huge rotation on their defensive line. So Jordan Phillips, 9.5 sacks. That came, if you look at his number of snaps played, it's probably significantly less to the guys around him. And I know he personally made a little bit of a, for lack of a better term, a stink, like, hey, why didn't I make a Pro Bowl? Why didn't I get all pro like recognition? Because I played so many less snaps compared to these guys that had more sacks than. So going on to the cycling the snap counts into the additions that the Bills made, they also made some along the defensive line. The biggest one was Mario Addison, a former Panthers player, more Buffalo North or Carolina North. The Bills front office head coach, I always be with the Panthers, so I don't know if you guys hear about this out there, but the Bills just signed so many former Panthers here. Like, you know them. It's pretty crazy. So they got another one here, Mario Addison. He's a guy who's I believe he's going to be 33 maybe when the season starts, 32, 33. So he's up there in age. But again, that rotation, he's not going to have as much wear and tear on him, hopefully. He's had at least 9 sacks each of the last four seasons. So the Bills are hoping to get some production out of him. Hopefully that rotation helps with his age. On top of that, a guy that probably doesn't need much introduction. You guys, or you're at least familiar with, Quentin Jefferson came over the Bills. They're hoping for him to be a little bit of a versatile piece there, formerly in the Seahawks. He can play in, he can play in the outside of the line, and then their top draft pick, second rounder, is A.J. Epenesa. They're hoping that he's eventually down the line, again, with that rotation. This rotation is playing a big part, if you couldn't tell, that all these guys are hopefully going to be able to come in, recycle, refresh at defensive line, because on that Bills stout defense, they have two great linebackers in Tremaine Edmonds and Matt Milano. Their secondary, Tre'Davious White, Jordan Poyer, and Micah Hyde, those guys have been great since 2017. So in regards to gains, those guys, hopefully that defensive line is going to keep churning out production to go along with the rest of the defense. And as I mentioned, Stephon Diggs was really just the carry on top of the Bills' overall roster. They were looking for that one piece. That's the one piece the Bills needed. John Brown, good season. You guys are familiar with him out there. He had a great season for the Bills last year, but not, like a perfect number two piece. Stephon Diggs, obviously number one piece. They gave a first-round pick and a bunch of other picks for him. Other than Stephon Diggs, the Bills, I know ESPN ran an article, what teams have the most continuity. The Bills have the most continuity on their roster from a year ago, so not a ton of additions, but obviously Stephon Diggs, you add a guy like that, they're really going to be banking a lot on him. And I think everyone in the league, after the way things ended in Minnesota, I think everyone around the nation is looking, Stephon Diggs in Buffalo, how's that going to work out? Well, we're gonna find out one way or another.
Right, and so we've seen quarterbacks do well in their second season, but in year three, we saw what happened with Mitchell Trubisky. There is definitely some debate about Josh Allen as to his staying power in terms of a passer. Is the addition of Diggs kind of the way to kind of hedge against that, giving him Diggs and giving him Brown? And then on top of that, you got Devin Singletary in the backfield. Do you expect to see more growth, or is he going to be kind of on the same level as he was last year, you think?
I think we're going to see at least a little bit of growth. As a rookie, no one kind of expected him to start. Now the punchline in the NFL is Nathan Peterman. He did look well that preseason. I'll give him that. He was playing backups, but he did look well, and they didn't want to put Allen in right away. Of course, that lasted about like 30 minutes, and then Josh Allen started playing again. And in the Bills, in his rookie season 2018, the Bills were 6-10, but they started four different quarterbacks that season. So as long as the Bills have gotten consistency under center, whether it's Tyrod Taylor back in 2017, whether it's Josh Allen last season, the defense has done enough. But in terms of Allen, again, to your point, we've seen these years. You hope for that year three. Is it going to be what we're going to see in year two? It was really Josh Allen's intermediate passing. Just he was kind of all over the place in those short to medium range. I mean, sometimes the guy, just yesterday, Madden said he's the strongest arm in the league. I really even just showed on his sharp passes that some of his, you don't have to gun it at a guy 6 yards away from you. And, like, he almost had to learn that you know, where to put these balls in the short range area. Now it's the deep ball. So Stephon Diggs, they're hoping that, you know, a couple of these contested catches, hopefully Stephon Diggs, that's his bread and butter. Hopefully he can bring a couple of those in. I guess I wrote about a week or two ago, Josh Allen is a rookie. He had about a 52% completion rating, not what you want at all. Last season, that went up to just about 58, 59%. And I was writing about the rookie tight end last season, Dawson Knox. He led the NFL in drops among tight ends with 10. If he catches five of those, cuts him in half. if he catches five of those passes, of those drops, Allen's totals are up to, I think it's 59.9%. So basically 60% what you want to see from your quarterback. Plus, maybe a couple catches from Stephon Diggs that are, wow, you know, Allen's in 60% range. That's assuming that everything else goes according to plan. So Allen did flash, and he's very much knocked for his dual threat ability. And I've kind of come around to the side of, hey, if he can do it, if he can run that ball, why not? He's never going to be Lamar Jackson. Who's going to be Lamar Jackson in this day and age? He's pretty unique. But, yeah, I think there is reason to believe that Allen can at least get a little bit better in year two. We're going to see. I think Diggs will make a difference.
Any other off-season stories other than personnel addition, subtraction? Obviously, I think kind of the biggest story in Buffalo is this their year with Tom Brady gone? Of course, that now is tempered because it looked like Cam Newton is a nice addition, But when you were looking at the Patriots roster with Jarrett Stidham potentially starting at quarterback, Buffalo fans are like, yeah. How is that looking now with Cam Newton?
I think that Buffalo is a very prideful place to say. When you're a fan base and you're sticking around for 2 decades and there's not a lot to care about, you're a pretty prideful place. And they're kind of going back into that area where whatever, Cam Newton, he's beat up. Like, no, it's still us. It's still us. Like, we're going to show you guys. So that's kind of like the mindset of Buffalo right now is we're going to show you guys that Cam Newton, he's not all that. And, you know, hopefully, again, I mentioned the former Panthers. Sean McDermott was his defensive coordinator, not his defensive coordinator, you know, the Panthers' defensive coordinator. For 4 or 5 seasons, practiced against Cam Newton, knows Cam Newton very well. Hopefully that'll play a part. But, yeah, in terms of other big additions that I might have skipped over, on offense, again, a lot of continuity. Very interested to see where a rookie rusher, Zach Moss, where he goes. He was the rookie out of Utah that now that the Bills really should have – I want to revert back to that Texans playoff game. Why they only gave Devin Singletary the ball 13 times was pretty crazy. He averaged like 6 yards a carry. But Devin Singletary with Zach Moss out of that backfield with Stephon Diggs, I think, is going to have a nice trickle-down effect too. So maybe we can add that under additions. John Brown, number one wide receiver, who knows? He still got 1,000 yards last season. Still great season out of him. Now he's going to get number two coverage. Maybe same for Dawson Knox. Maybe down the seam he finds some openings from tight end. Cole Beasley too on the inside. So really just Stephon Diggs is – him, his trickle-down effect is a big thing. And the Bills' defense, I mean, it's like I said, it's really overlooked in the league. Some of the most underrated guys, I think, on there. But hopefully that tide starts to change with Buffalo being a small market. Tre'Davious White has finally started to get his national recognition, Pro Bowl last season, All-Pro. He's fantastic cornerback. So we'll see. I know when we talk, when we do our little preview here to wrap up Bills' cards, I got a good matchup there. It's a little,
okay,
little teaser.
So give me what your expectations are for the season, record prediction, and how do you think they match up against the Cardinals?
Well, for this season, you know, like I said, 1995, it's AFC East or bust for this team, Cam Newton and all. And it's crazy to think that the Bills are now finally in this discussion. But, again, it's not – and, of course, the Bills, they've been the professional – professionals, they always try to be and say, you know, it's Bill Belichick's division until we knock him off, and it's true. We're very much focusing on Tom Brady, Gronk. That defense is still really good over there, so it's not going to be any easier for Josh Allen Co. So that's the goal, AFC East. I'm a little bit on the fence. I mentioned earlier they have a tougher, much tougher schedule, Cardinals among them. I'm looking at something, again, like 10-6 again. I think that's going to be the area. A lot of folks are thinking 11, 12 wins. I'm kind of pumping the brakes. They are playing a lot more difficult teams this season, so that would be my prediction. We're going to go to the Bills-Cardinals, the matchup I was kind of teasing there. Tre'Davious White, his best battles by far that he's had in the NFL, of course, Hopkins. They've gone back in that playoff game. It was like three quarters Tre'Davious White had him. Then at the end, it's just, you know, how much you need to stop one of the best receivers in the last decade or two. Even when they played in the regular season, I think twice, that was actually one of my big matchups to watch all season. I wrote a story for every single game. That's going to be a great one to watch. It might even come down to that one. But I think as well as that, it's going to be how does Allen develop by week 10 against this Cardinals defense. It's very much looking to improve from last season, of course. Really can only go up from here. So they're probably going to be better. Is Josh Allen going to be better? Is really what it might come down to.
Absolutely. Now, for your benefit, the Cardinals' defense in terms of pass defense, they allowed an average passer rating of 109. And we know that 100 is elite. So basically, they made every quarterback look like a Hall of Famer last year. Let's hope that doesn't happen again. So
Yeah.
Thank you for your time, Nick. You can find his work at BillsWire.com. It's a USA Today site, BillsWire.USAToday.com. Nick, can they find you on Twitter or other social media?
Of course, yeah, Twitter. I think everything else, I'm at Nick_Wotan. That's W-O-J as in Jack, T-O-N. And, of course, at the Bills Wire. So.
We appreciate Nick taking the time to talk about the Bills and preview that for us. Coming to next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We move on to the Cardinals' next opponent, not their next game. They got the Seattle Seahawks in week 11, but in week 12, they take on the New England Patriots. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Next up on our preview is the Cardinals' week 12 battle on the road against the New England Patriots. It'll be one of the tougher games the Cardinals have this year, especially late in the year where weather could be a factor. And to help us get to know what's happened with the Patriots over the last roughly a year, we've brought on Patriots Wire managing editor Henry McKenna. Glad to have him. Henry, how's everything going?
It's going well, all things considered. Obviously, it's a tough time for everyone, but football might be around the corner, and I think that's something that I know I'm getting excited for, long as it's done safely.
It looks like we're on track for football to actually happen. I hope, for the sake of everyone involved, football fans and the whole country and our jobs as well, that football can actually happen so we can enjoy and work. It's kind of both sides. So let's take it back to the 2019 season. The Patriots didn't finish, obviously, the way they wanted to finish, because that's a franchise that's used to championships. Tell us what was the success level last year for the team? What went well? What could have gone better?
Yeah, so the running game fell apart when compared to 2018. In 2018, the Patriots relied heavily on Sony Michel to power them through the playoffs, basically. Michel had a pretty crazy stat line from those playoffs. I think it was about 100 yards a game and 6 total touchdowns. I'll pull those stats up while I'm talking here. But essentially, he and that offensive line were sort of the lifeblood of the team. And then in 2019, it all sort of fell apart. And what we saw was that Tom Brady and that group of pass catchers really needed the offensive line and Sony Michel to keep it together. So when they were unable to do so, the Patriots were sort of scrambling. They were trying to figure out how they were going to get offensive production out of a 42-year-old quarterback who, you know, people didn't want to admit was declining, but was, and didn't have the supporting cast to help prevent that decline. It was sort of like a unfortunate storm, perfect storm, to sort of highlight Brady's weaknesses all of a sudden, rather than highlight his strengths. That's what the Patriots have always done. So when that play started slipping on offense, it had so many impacts. The run game affected the pass, obviously. The defense was probably the best in the league, and that was bolstered, I think, partially from a really weak strength of schedule for the first half, and then things got a little bit harder down the second half. So, but ultimately, they were competitive with the team that went to the AFC Championship game, the Tennessee Titans, in the first round of the playoffs in that wild card round. But, you know, they shouldn't have had to play in that wild card round. They should have beaten the Dolphins. They should have had a bye week. They should have probably gotten to the AFC Championship again, where I think they probably would have lost to the Kansas City Chiefs. But that sort of fateful loss to the Dolphins in Week 17 was a disaster. And so, too, you know, was Tom Brady's final throw as a Patriot. He threw an interception.
Yeah. That was a really disappointing, like, in terms of football. I know there's the Tom Brady and the Patriots are very polarizing nationally, but when you look at the type of career he's had, to have it, and we see it from other quarterbacks. I mean, Brett Favre, it didn't end well for, it usually doesn't end well for quarterbacks unless you go out while you're still good, and Brady wants to play forever. Defensively, what was it that made that defense, well, it made it look at least special, like one of the best defensive units, at least statistically, we've seen in quite some time?
Yeah, I think it was the cornerbacks. They had They were five deep, and I am not exaggerating, five deep at cornerback, which was remarkable. Stephon Gilmore won Defensive Player of the Year. Jason McCourty played very well, struggled with a hamstring injury. So I think later in the season, it was clear that he didn't have the same burst, and so they actually put him in a rotation with this young guy, J.C. Jackson, who's not getting enough love around the NFL. I think he could very quickly emerge as one of the best cornerbacks in the NFL. He started to, like, Pro Football Focus absolutely loves J.C. Jackson, ranks him as one of the top cornerbacks in the NFL already. I think it's a little too early to say that, but so he's been great on the outside along and sort of in a rotation with Jason McCourty, and then they have a slot cornerback in Jonathan Jones, who covered Tyreek Hill at times over the last few seasons, with some help, obviously. I went four deep, right? I should say they're just four deep at cornerback, but that's still a pretty remarkable level of depth for one of the hardest positions to find high quality players in the NFL. So I think it really starts there with their defense. And I think ultimately we're going to see over the next few years that that's where all defenses will start. I think, you know, we used to think of the pass rusher as the most important position, but the Patriots are showing that cornerback is more important. And I think, you know, again, this is a Pro Football Focus point, and my colleague over at For the Win, another website under the USA Today umbrella, Stephen Ruiz, has been pointing this out too. There's going to be a shift where people realize that cornerbacks are more important than pass rushers. So the Patriots, as usual, seem to be ahead of that trend.
They do indeed. Now, this offseason is a season, it's an offseason of transition for the Patriots. They've lost, obviously, at this point, if you don't know that Tom Brady's no longer on the Patriots, you're missing something. He now is on the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. It wasn't necessarily acrimonious, but it wasn't the happiest of goodbyes, at least from afar out in the West. It didn't look like it was ideal, but it wasn't bad. But they not only lost Brady, they also lost a number of key contributors, particularly on the defense side of the balls. Who are the biggest losses in free agency and or trades that the Patriots are going to have to do without this year?
Yeah. So Brady, obviously, you touched on that. And then I'd say Kyle Van Noy is a player who went underappreciated for a long time nationally, and then all of a sudden he got that just ridiculous deal from the Miami Dolphins this offseason, just so much money. So that was a sort of a recognition that, you know, maybe the media was missing the mark on Van Noy not being, you know, not praising him as one of the best linebackers in the NFL, but clearly he's one of them. And then Jamie Collins, a guy who kind of one and done to the Patriots, which is, I think, what they expected. They signed him for a year, veteran minimum, and basically said, hey, we're going to get you back to the elite level you were playing when we traded you, before we traded you to the Browns.
And he said, got paid twice. He got big contracts twice because of his play with New England.
Exactly, yeah. And in both cases, the play sort of started well and declined. Last year, he looked like a Defensive Player of the Year candidate for eight games. And then the final eight games, you know, he slipped a little bit and lost some of his snaps because of it. Landon Roberts is sort of a minor character on the defense, but he contributed as an inside linebacker, and even as a fullback, he did some work on special teams. So those, I guess, that linebacking group is sort of where the biggest departures happened on defense.
And I think another underappreciated loss will be Danny Shelton, a guy that I secretly, well, not secretly, I wanted the Cardinals to pick up in free agency. I thought he was a perfect fit for the middle of their defense. Now, moving ahead, obviously we had the late addition of Cam Newton, but who are the players that the Patriots have added? Who will have the biggest impact, whether it's free agency or the draft? And who are some underrated contributors that you're expecting to see this year?
Yeah, so I guess I kind of want to start in the draft where the two tight ends come into play. Well, I guess I should actually, before I depart from departures, some names I didn't mention. Steven Gostkowski, the kicker. The Patriots replaced him with a rookie from the draft. Center Ted Karras, who's important because David Andrews had blood clots in his lungs. And he couldn't play for a year. He should be playing this year, but that's a serious problem. And so to not have depth like Karras, who was the starter, that could be complicated. And then Daron Harmon got traded away. He played safety, but I think he's easily replaced with the safeties they drafted and signed. But yeah, going back to the arrivals. So the tight end group is what I think has the most buzz in New England. The Patriots spent 2 third-round picks on that position. They got UCLA tight end Devin Asiasi, a guy who only had one season of production with the Bruins, but it was an impressive one. And I think because it was only one season, he slipped down the draft board. But I think he's such a nice fit for New England's offense that he will probably contribute in year one. And the same is true of Dalton Keene. He's a Virginia Tech kid. He compares athletically to George Kittle, but he's sort of a stranger football player than Kittle in that Kittle played tight end at Iowa. He wasn't that productive, interestingly enough, much like Keene, has sort of a lack of production at Virginia Tech. But Keene played all over the offense, and he did some sort of interesting things, playing H-back, playing tight end, playing fullback. I think the Patriots are actually going to do something similar. They're going to make him play the position their way, which is vastly different than the way that Virginia Tech had him. But I think it will be an interestingly versatile option for New England. And you hate to bring up Aaron Hernandez as a football comparison because obviously from sort of legal and
right.
And so many, I mean, he killed people. I think from a football standpoint, though, the Patriots used Aaron Hernandez in very interesting ways as a running back, as a move tight end, as an H-back. And Keene is not as well-polished of a football player, but there's time for Keene to develop and potentially have some versatility in that offense. So I think they're both players are going to come along and probably quickly because the Patriots tight end group was the absolute worst last season. So for them to have ample opportunity to get snaps right away, maybe they won't contribute right away, but by the end of the season, I would expect them to take big roles in the offense.
Looking ahead, looking at the quarterback position, they ended up with Cam Newton. I sort of felt it was inevitable they were going to go that sort of route, but were they really going to roll with Jarrett Stidham? And just, well, how much confidence and optimism do you have for his talent? Or were we looking at a scenario where this was going to be their down year if it hadn't been for Newton getting signed?
I don't think Belichick ever plans for down years. That guy wants to win every single year. I think they were probably comfortable riding with Brian Hoyer or Jarrett Stidham. I don't think that they were excited about it. I think the Cam Newton signing is pretty clear evidence that they were not super pumped to be going with those two guys. Hoyer was an option that was sort of like insurance in the event that Stidham wasn't ready. And I think there was a good chance he was not going to be ready. So they were going to kind of like ride with an offense that really needed to be powered by its running game. And I don't think that they were super comfortable. So it would have looked a lot like 2000 when Tom Brady took over. Like,
right.
Like, you know, we've seen Tom Brady, you know, we passed the 2007 season. The perception of Tom Brady has totally changed, right? Because before that, he was considered a game manager who was not statistically or physically impressive in any way. But 2000 changed everything where people thought, okay, Tom Brady's actually an elite quarterback, not just a Super Bowl winning quarterback, not just a product of Bill Belichick. Well, this would be a trip back to those early years of Belichick and Brady. But of course, it would be with either Hoyer or Stidham. Now, with Cam Newton, we're going to see something totally different and totally more creative, where Josh McDaniels and Belichick and Newton will get to do really cool and different with what they build in terms of an offense. Now, Newton has to win the starting job, which is complicated because they're hosting this open competition, and the offense will probably look very different between any one of those three quarterbacks. But everybody kind of knows that Newton's going to win that job as long as he stays healthy. So I imagine they're already building packages, plays, wrinkles, everything they can to make Newton comfortable in that offense.
Looking ahead to this season, ceiling and floor. Bills fans and the Bills believe this is the year that they can take the division. I think the Dolphins are a sneaky team in terms of what they could be. What are your expectations? What's their ceiling of expectation this year that you think they can get, and what's their low end, their floor?
So my thought is that they're going to win the AFC East. I did not think that they were going to be able to prior to the Newton signing. I thought Josh Allen would play well enough over a season so that the Bills could overtake the Patriots. And I even think that the Dolphins are going to be a sneakily good team this year, like well exceeding what people expect of them.
Same.
They just got a ridiculous amount of talent this offseason, both in the draft and free agency. I think that the Patriots will probably win the AFC. I think they could make it to the AFC Championship game with Cam Newton if he's healthy. Now, if he gets hurt, they're probably like a 7-9 team.
Now, what do you think how do you think they match up against the Cardinals? Where do you see? I don't want a prediction. It's way too early. But how do you think the Patriots defensively match up to the Cardinals offense and vice versa?
Oh, it's so hard to say right now. I can't pretend like I'm super familiar with like the Cardinals defense especially, but the offense I can speak to, and it would be a really fun matchup because of what we were just talking about with the cornerbacks. The cornerbacks against this air raid offense that the Cardinals have will be really fun, and the Patriots are trying to get faster in the box. You can see that they drafted this safety from Lenoir Rhyne named Kyle Duggar in the second round. Kind of surprised some people, even though there was chatter that he'd go in the second round. But Kyle Duggar is a weird and huge athlete who's crazy fast, crazy tall. Going to play safety, probably going to cover some tight ends, but also might do some like spying. And guys like Kyler Murray, who can beat you with legs and throws. They have tormented the Patriots for so many years now. I mean, going back to Cam Newton, it's been bad. Deshaun Watson, Cam Newton, Blake Bortles, Mitchell Trubisky, like even Bortles and Trubisky, guys who are pretty good athletes, but not necessarily sort of like the obvious runners. Those guys were running for crazy yardage on the Patriots because they could. I think the Patriots will have a way to stop the passing offense, and then we will see whether the Patriots have finally figured out how to get an answer to an offense that has a running quarterback.
Well, we look forward to that matchup. It's going to be a cold. Well, hopefully it won't be too cold because, no, that's kind of we like it warm. But thanks for coming on to the show, Henry. You can find him at patriotswire.com also for the win. And on Twitter, if you want to check him out, he's at McKennalysis. So you've got McKenna, the last name, C-K-N-N-A, blended with analysis. They share the A. Thanks for coming on, as always. Henry, I appreciate your time. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And we move on to the Cardinals' next opponent, the LA Rams, whom they will face in Week 13 and Week 17. We've got another preview and another guest. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Next up on the schedule for the Cardinals is the LA Rams, their division rival. They will take on the Rams twice. They will play them in Week 13 at home and end the season on the road. And continuing with the previews, we have a guest with us tonight, today, the Rams Wire, the managing editor of the NFL Wire site, Cameron DeSilva. Cameron, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on for a few minutes and talking some NFC West football. How are you doing, man?
Good. I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So let's go ahead and get started. Let's talk about, talking about last year, what went well? Like, obviously the Rams were expected to be much better than they ended up being. What happened last year, and what was the feeling entering the offseason?
Yeah, so last season, it was kind of a disappointing year because coming off that Super Bowl loss, they really still had a lot of firepower on the roster. They still had Todd Gurley, and even though he was kind of coming off a knee injury, the offense still looked really strong. Brandon Cooks, Robert Woods, Cooper Kupp, Tyler Higbee, Gerald Everett. So they had the makings of a really good offense. Things just kind of fell apart on the offensive line with injuries and just poor play after Roger Saffold left and John Sullivan essentially retired. So they had issues there, and it sputtered all season. And then the defense, they kind of tweaked and traded Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib, brought in Jalen Ramsey. The defense was better than it was the year before, I would say, just more inconsistent. And they had great games against some teams like the Cardinals. They really shut down, as you probably remember. And then they had poor showings against the Ravens and against the Cowboys and the Buccaneers. So just an up and down season that really was short of expectations.
All right. So they go into the offseason. One of the first things that happens is they do some changes on the coaching staff for the first time. Sean McVay has an offensive coordinator, and they move on from Wade Phillips. What sort of impact are both moves, do you think, are going to have entering this season?
Yeah, it was kind of unusual for the Rams to go through that many changes that were initiated by them. Usually it's Sean McVay losing a quarterback's coach or an offensive coordinator to another team hiring him as their head coach. But this year was kind of the opposite. They moved on from Wade Phillips. They could have brought him back. They moved on from their running backs coach, Skip Pete. Their special teams coordinator left. So there were a lot of changes that were kind of unexpected. And so I think the defense is the most interesting part, because you're going from Wade Phillips, who really just deploys this consistent 3-4 scheme. You know what you're going to get. You know you're going to get pressure off the edge with their edge defenders. It's almost like a 4-3 system, essentially. But now you're going to Brandon Staley, who has never been a defensive coordinator. He worked under Vic Fangio. He's really big into these outside linebackers and the pass rushers. So I think there's going to be an emphasis on kind of versatility up front with the defensive line and with the secondary, as well as the edge rushers. So the defense is going to look different. You don't have Clay Matthews. You don't have Dante Fowler. You don't have Corey Littleton. So they did lose a lot of players on that side of the ball. And then as well, you have Eric Weddle, who retired. But and then on the offensive side, you have Kevin O'Connell coming in. He's the first offensive coordinator that McVay has had since, I want to say, 2018. So he comes over from the Redskins, someone that McVay worked with before and knows well off the field. He's essentially going to be their quarterbacks coach too. He's going to help throughout the week with game planning and on Sundays with essentially just managing the game with Sean McVay, making sure McVay doesn't get away from the run too much, things like that. So I think it'll be a positive development for them, even with these kind of surprising changes, but I'm interested to see how it works out for them.
Okay, moving on to personnel in free agency. Who were the impact losses? Who were the impact losses? Who do they have on the roster to replace them? And how does that look moving forward with the changes of those positions?
I think the biggest free agency losses that they went through were Dante Fowler at outside linebacker and then Corey Littleton at inside linebacker. They both signed pretty sizable contracts with their new teams. Fowler went to the Falcons and then Littleton to the Raiders. And those were two of their biggest losses, I would say. Michael Brockers was also a free agent, but the Rams, he was supposed to leave and sign with the Ravens. that deal fell apart after his physical, and they found a little issue, I think, with his ankle. But the Rams were able to re-sign him, bring him back. But going back to linebacker, at inside linebacker, it's kind of a mess, to be honest. If you look at their depth chart, you're not going to notice a lot of recognizable names. You got Micah Kizer, Traven Howard, Troy Reader, Kenny Young. Not exactly a star-studded group that's in line to replace Littleton, but they're kind of relying on this youth and these unproven guys, which could be a risk because it's such an important position in the NFL today, especially if you get guys who can run and cover the middle of the field. But at outside linebacker, it's going to be Leonard Floyd came in. He was one of their free agency additions. So he's going to replace one side of the defensive, the outside linebacker position, most likely Clay Matthews' spot, which is more of that run defending strong side outside linebacker. And on the other side, it's going to be either Terrell Lewis, who's a rookie they drafted in the third round. You got Obo Okoronkwo, who was a fourth round pick a few years ago by with Wade Phillips there. And then Samson Ebukam, who was a starter 2 years ago, he's going to be competing there too. So a lot of competition on this defense, a lot of unproven players, and it's going to be something to watch throughout training camp and if there is a preseason into those exhibition games.
On the offensive side of the ball, you brought Andrew Whitworth back, right?
Yep. They re-signed him this offseason.
Okay, Brandon Cooks is out. Todd Gurley's out. The running back room looks unproven at best. I mean, you've got Cam Akers, you've got Darrell Henderson, who I thought he was going to be much better as a rookie than he was. Yeah. Now, he was dinged up most of the year, wasn't he?
Yeah, I wouldn't say most of the year, but towards the end of the season, he had a little bit of an ankle issue. He had surgery for that, but it was more just less playing time than people expected for him.
And do you anticipate that Cam Akers will eventually be the guy, or even early in the season will be the number one back, or do you think that'll end up being Darrell Henderson early on?
No, I think it'll be Cam Akers, whether that's in week one or by midseason. I think just the fact that they spent their first draft pick on him, it's less need. Their GM loves trading back in the draft, and that's something that he passed on, which was kind of surprising with the 52nd overall pick. He stood pat and he drafted Cam Akers. And I was surprised by that, but obviously that's a testament to how much they like this kid. So he has kind of the makings of your typical bell cow running back. He can catch, he can run between the tackles, he can run outside. He can do everything. And he's essentially the complete package, a combination of Darrell Henderson and Malcolm Brown, who are probably going to be the immediate backups. So it's kind of a best of both worlds. He can do everything. He was that workhorse at Florida State behind a terrible offensive line, so he has experience in that regard. And I think he's going to be a guy who really has a strong rookie season if he gets enough touches, which I think he will.
At receiver, you've got Robert Woods, very consistent with the Rams. You've got Cooper Kupp, again, super consistent, but you lose the dynamic potential playmaking of Brandon Cooks, although he missed a bit of time last year, replaced by Josh Reynolds and or Van Jefferson. And you've got Tyler Higbee as your main tight end. Mm-hmm. How does the passing game change?
We saw it change a little bit towards the end of last season. It's going to be different without the speed of Brandon Cooks. He's a guy who can really stretch the field and stretch a defense and make them really stay on their toes and play deep coverage. But we saw it change towards the end of last season. The Rams went to more two tight end packages, more heavy sets. They even used the fullback a little bit. And there were a lot of targets going to Tyler Higbee at tight end, a lot of underneath passes to Cooper Kupp and Robert Woods. So I think we're going to see more of that this season. You have Gerald Everett, who's a really good number two tight end and someone who Rams fans have been waiting to break out for several years since he came into the league as Sean McVay's first pick with the Rams. So I think you do have a lot of these different personnel packages that they can use, whether it's with two tight ends, two receivers, and you can even use two backs with Cam Akers and Darrell Henderson, and all of those guys are capable receivers, which opens things up for Jared Goff and doesn't really just limit him to these wide receivers being his top targets. So I think you'll see more targets going to the tight ends, more to the running backs, and hopefully taking some pressure off of Robert Woods and Cooper Kupp, who have been just stellar and consistent for the Rams over the past couple of years.
In terms of production, I mean, you know you're going to get production from Woods. You know you're going to get it from Kupp. Defensively, you know you're going to get great play from Aaron Donald. Who are the other contributors entering this season you expect to stand out or surprise?
Yeah, I think Josh Reynolds is going to have a solid year if he does kind of beat out Van Jefferson for that number three wide receiver role. He was a starter 2 years ago when Cooper Kupp went down, and he showed good potential. He's got good speed. He's kind of a long strider. He's not anyone that's going to really blow by you like Brandon Cooks would with his 4.2 or 4.3 speed, whatever he has. But Reynolds is he's their tallest receiver. He's, like I said, he's a long strider, so I think he can make plays deep downfield. So I think he's someone to watch. On defense, Troy Hill, he's a guy who has been inconsistent for the Rams over the past couple of years. He had a suspension. Rams fans are just kind of, at some point last offseason, they were just over him and didn't really want to give him a chance. But as soon as they traded Marcus Peters and Aqib Talib, he stepped up and he was honestly their best cornerback last season. So he's a guy that I'm going to watch opposite Jalen Ramsey, because, you know, quarterbacks are going to shy away from throwing his way. So I think you'll see a lot of targets going Troy Hill's direction. And if he can hold up in coverage, it's going to be a huge lift for the defense.
And looking ahead for the 2020 season, do you think the Rams still have what it takes to stay competitive in the NFC West? They appear to be a team that could still be really good, but there are many who feel that they're also slipping, and this might be another down year for them. What is your personal belief for the outlook of the Rams this season, and how do you think they match up with the Cardinals? Like, it's going to be, we're still months down the road because it's December and January, like this past year. But how do you see the Cardinals and Rams matching up in addition to how you think the Rams will do this year?
Yeah, I think the Rams are kind of, they're not as I wouldn't say overhyped, but they don't have the expectations that they did a couple of years ago when they signed Dominican Sue and they were going to the Super Bowl and they had this stacked roster with all these stars and Jared Goff was getting paid and Todd Gurley was getting paid and they're making all these trades. I think now they're kind of in, I wouldn't say reset mode, but they've been more conservative in their roster building ways. They know that they can't go out and make all these deals and pay everyone because of the salary cap. I do think they still have the roster to make a playoff run. As long as Jared Goff really elevates himself and bounces back from a bad 2019 season and improves again, if the offensive line gets better with all of these young guys that they do have up front, I think that'll make a world of difference. And then Cam Akers, hopefully he can provide a spark that Todd Gurley really didn't last season with that bulky knee. So I think they do have the talent. They just have to put it all together. That defense, when you have Aaron Donald and Jalen Ramsey on the same side of the ball, you know that's going to be a defense that teams are kind of worried about. So there shouldn't be too much trouble on that side. But with regards to their matchup with the Cardinals specifically, I think they're both going to be competing for that third spot probably in the NFC West. Kyler Murray, I'm really high on him. I think he could be another guy who wins MVP in his second season, kind of like Lamar and Patrick Mahomes did. I think the Cardinals are going to be a good team. I think they're going to be right there around 500 or above that mark. The defense is good. Chandler Jones is one of the most underrated players in the league. Patrick Peterson's still there. You got Buda Baker, who's playing well at safety. So it's a talented team. I think the Rams are kind of in that same mix where you could see them right around the 500 mark. But it's going to be a fun season in the NFC West because there's so many good teams and they can all make a run to the playoffs and to a Super Bowl, in my opinion.
Do the Rams sweep the Cardinals again as they have for the last 3 years?
Oh, man, it's been so lopsided the past couple of years. I can't see that happening again. I think they'll probably split or be somewhere playing close games. So I think it'll be a fun matchup for those two games that they do play.
What's your record prediction for the Rams?
I don't remember exactly what my record was when we did the predictions after the schedule came out, but I think their range is going to be somewhere between 7-9 and 11-5. I'll split the difference and say 9-7. Even as disappointing as last season was, a 9-7 record with a top 15 offense and scoring all the points that they did, it was still, I would say, a successful season when you finish above 500 in a difficult division. So I think they'll be right around 9-7, I'll say again, for this season.
All right. Thanks, Cameron, for coming on. Again, this is Cameron DeSilva from the Rams Wire, part of the USA Today NFL Network, NFL Wire sites. Cam, how can we find you on Twitter? Is it just easiest to hit you up on the site?
Yeah, I'm on Twitter at Cam DeSilva. All my published work is at the Rams Wire. So you can find me there and find everything we're talking about with the Rams.
Thanks, Cam, for the time to preview the Rams and for the time on the show. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web, we move on to Week 14. The Cardinals take on the New York Giants. That's right, we've got another preview and another guest. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web, and we move on to talk about the New York Giants, one of the Cardinals' late-season opponents, as they'll face them in, I believe, it's Week 14. We have a guest to help talk about what to expect from the Giants, what they've done over the last, in the offseason, the last season, and that is the Giants. So Giants Wire's managing editor, Dan Benton. Dan, how is everything, and thanks for coming on the show.
Happy and healthy, Jess. I appreciate you having me on. I'm just happy to talk some football, get back to the NFL, and, you know, forget about COVID for a couple minutes.
Yes, and so the Giants last year, well, the Cardinals were one of the teams to beat them last year.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Cardinals, drafted a quarterback early in Daniel Jones. They have some optimism, but they're going through transition. Let's start with last season. What went well? Well, obviously it wasn't a successful season overall, but what was your take on how things went last year? Where did things go wrong? And what was there to build on?
Well, I think it was they've been in a rebuild for years now. It's what it feels like. But last year was, I would call it the first year of the actual transition under Dave Gettleman. And that really didn't even happen until week three when they moved from Eli Manning to Daniel Jones. And then we kind of finally got into that flow, a look at what's to come for the Giants. Unfortunately, a lot went right. Injuries were obviously the big story on the offensive side of the ball. Daniel Jones, I don't think he took a single snap with all of his offensive playmakers, that being Saquon Barkley, Evan Ingram, Golden Tate, Sterling Shepard, et cetera. So it's really hard to, even right there, it's hard to start and be like, well, what went wrong? Well, pretty much everything went wrong at that point. On the defensive side of the ball, things certainly weren't any better at all. They gave up the second most points in franchise history, which is pretty remarkable when you consider how long it's been around and functioning as a professional football team. And the last time they gave up 450 or more points in a single season, you have to go back to the 60s, which was really a dark time for the Giants franchise. So that puts in perspective just how bad things actually were. But again, the injuries, the suspensions, there was obviously a whole lot of drama. They ended up firing their coach, shuffling over the coaching staff at the end of the season. It feels like it's just constant turnover, and I'm hoping that maybe now we're on the other side of that. But when looking back on last year and things that went, it's really hard to pick out any one single thing because it was really like a Murphy's Law kind of situation where everything that could go wrong did go wrong for the Giants, and there weren't very many positives. So take your pick, basically, when you want to know what went wrong last year.
So, but what is the feeling about Daniel Jones moving forward? I know there is, especially on the West Coast, a lot of fans don't necessarily get the Daniel Jones hype, but mm-hmm. What is it about him that has Giants fans excited?
I think there's actually a lot to like about Daniel Jones. Admittedly, when they first drafted him, I was surprised. I was taken aback by the choice. I thought it was a possibility, but unlikely. So one of the very first things that I did after the Giants drafted Jones is I went back and watched every single snap of his Duke career. And I came away from that film thinking to myself, you know what? Maybe Gettleman actually got this right. There's a lot to like about this. He didn't have a lot of weapons at Duke. In fact, I think he only played with one player who got drafted in the NFL over the course of his entire college career, which puts into perspective his production at the college level. Obviously, turnovers are a little bit of an issue, and that's something I'm sure we'll touch on over the course of, you know, the football season and when we talk about what's going on this offseason. But as far as what to like about Daniel Jones, first of all, he's an extremely hard worker. He really kind of takes a page out of the book of Eli, is the best way to put it. He's really dedicated to his craft. He's a bit of a perfectionist. He's a student of the game. He's got a high football IQ, and he puts a lot of pressure on himself to perfect everything. Obviously, he's got some scrambling ability. He's not the fastest quarterback in the league, but it does put the Giants back in the conversation of teams that are kind of keeping up with the current landscape of the NFL, whereas they haven't really prior to that. They hung on to Eli Manning, which, you know, I'm not going to complain about. I love Eli personally, but the reality is the NFL had kind of passed him by at that point. The game is getting faster, and they needed that quarterback to kind of be able to keep plays moving. Daniel Jones gives him that. He also clearly has a clutch factor in him, which is just not something you could teach. Either you've got it or you don't have it. We saw it at times last year that he's definitely got it. He certainly has to get better with his decision-making, but I think that comes with time. I don't think you could pinpoint any real rookie quarterback and be like, they're perfect. They're making every throw. They're making every good decision. Just doesn't happen that way. So, and, you know, the fact that he was able to accomplish what he was able to accomplish, and he set all kinds of team records. There were some NFL records. He came just shy of breaking touchdown records and things like that. And considering he only played in 13 games and didn't once have the full complement of awesome offensive players, you know, that speaks volumes about the potential that Daniel Jones actually has. And I think that's the big word when it comes to him. Giants fans love him because they see what he can be and not necessarily what he is right now, which is what he's getting constantly judged on by fans outside of the East Rutherford and New York areas.
Now, this is come from a Cardinals perspective. What did you think of the James Betcher defenses that for the time that he was there? Because he really gave fans over here some mixed feelings, mm-hmm. because it, especially after Todd Bowles left, they weren't totally bought in on him, but the production, the statistical side, yep. said they were good in Arizona. Mm-hmm. Obviously, he didn't have the same success statistically in New York. What was the take of Betcher's defenses when he was there?
You know, to be fair to Betcher, I think one of the biggest problems that he faced was the lack of personnel for his style of defense. The Giants just didn't have it, and that kind of began with Jerry Reese. And the bottom line is the last few years of his tenure at general manager, they just didn't hit well in the draft. Early rounds, mid rounds, late rounds, they were struggling across the board. They weren't necessarily finding great players in free agency. They were overspending on players. And that really manifested itself in Betcher's defense, where he had a very specific scheme that he was going to work with, but the personnel didn't necessarily match the scheme itself. And as a result, as I mentioned before, you know, they were giving up a ton of points. They just weren't performing well across the board. Partially you could blame him, because it's really up to the coaches to create a defense, to create a scheme, to maximize what it is that the players can do as opposed to what they can't do. And he really didn't hit on all cylinders when it came to that. But again, I kind of give him a partial pass just because the personnel, it just wasn't there for him. And unfortunately, even going into 2020 now, the personnel still isn't there now. And it's, you know, it's a work in progress, and maybe they're a couple years off from really, you know, formidable defense again, which is sad because that's obviously what the Giants are known for traditionally and historically. But as far as Betcher goes, I really think the lack of personnel hurt him. His unwillingness to adjust to that personnel hurt him. And in the end, it all just hurt.
That's kind of how we feel it as well. He wasn't super flexible. He needed guys to be able to do specific things. So let's fast forward a little bit. So new coaching staff, a coaching hire that seemed to almost come out of nowhere in Joe Judge, as opposed, what didn't it feel like that the Giants were targeting Matt Rhule? I'm trying to think back. They were felt like they were targeting Matt Rhule. He ends up going to Carolina. You guys end up with Joe Judge. What's the vibe with Joe Judge? Obviously, you know, special teams receivers coach with New England. What does he bring to the table so far?
Well, I got to tell you, I'll admit, similar to Daniel Jones being drafted, I really didn't expect Jones. I don't think anybody expected Jones to be hired by the Giants. That really came out of left field. I really thought it was going to be Rule or it was going to be McCarthy. And when Judge came in, I'm like, you know, all right, they're throwing Belichick a bone maybe because he still has, you know, ties to the organization. He's still friendly with them. But even then, you kind of question it because a year prior or 2 years prior, he didn't allow Josh McDaniels to interview with the Giants. So there was, you know, there was some level of confusion over that and why McDaniels was allowed or not allowed to come in. Judge was allowed to come in. It's just a weird hire. But truth be told, after meeting with Judge a few times when he met with the media and you kind of listen to him and you listen to his philosophy and who he is, there was a lot to like about the guy. He is really hard-nosed. He's really specific. He's very team-oriented. There will be no excuses whatsoever. If you don't play team first ball, you're not going to play, period. It's very Tom Coughlin-like. And I think maybe Giants fans, and even myself, could be guilty of this. You kind of fall into the nostalgia, and you're like, you know, this team was really lacking that kind of attitude under Ben McAdoo and Pat Shurmur. So, you know, there's a part of me that's like, I love that. I love that disciplinarian, military style of head coach. But at the same time, you kind of look at Joe Judge and what he's done in New England, everything like that, and wonder, how does that fit on a grand scale where he is the man running the show, having never done that before? If he runs the team in the same way he runs his meetings, sign me up all day long. But until you actually get out there on the field and see what he's bringing to the table, see how his players react to him, you don't really know. It's really a guessing game. And unfortunately, a product of this offseason is we've not actually had the opportunity to see that yet. So we're not really sure how his players are going to take to that. Because if you think back and remember when Tom Coughlin came in, the player not a big fan of that style of game.
Well, the Cardinals, it's one of those things. Because Steve Wilks, he looked like a fantastic hire for the Cardinals in 2018. Mm-hmm. And then it just looked like he was in over his head. He ran a very tight ship, was super detail oriented. And when the losses started pouring on, then he lost players kind of lost the respect for it. Like, that's one of the things that's hard. If you're hard nosed and disciplined, it's good if it starts yielding results. Mm-hmm. But if that's the downside.
And the other problem with Judge is that he's a first-year guy. Yeah. You know, it's not like he's a Tom Coughlin coming in with the reputation that he has where the players are like, well, you kind of got to respect this guy because he's had a certain level
of
success.
They have to feel it out,
before.
And they're like, what's this guy got?
And so if the losses start immediately piling up out of the gate this year, it's going to be interesting to see how the players react to that disciplinarian style, because when you're losing, things are miserable. When you're losing and things are miserable on top of the losing, that's when the wheels really begin to come off a team. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, in the face of that, Judge is able to hang on to his players and keep them all sort of centered as opposed to losing them, which Tom Coughlin admittedly did prior to the 2007 season.
So let's move forward a little more in the offseason. Impact losses, who are the biggest losses? Who are the biggest additions? And how does that impact them this year, and even who are the players in the draft that you anticipate impacting, making a contribution as rookies? So free agent losses, free agent gains, and draft important draft picks.
You know, it's kind of funny. When I was preparing for this, I was looking at the scorecard because I run the scorecard every year on the free seat. And the Giants, outside of Manning retiring, the Giants didn't really lose anything. They could technically still lose Marcus Golden, even though I don't anticipate that happening. I expect him to be back. But outside of that, you know, basically you're looking at people like Antonio Hamilton, who really didn't factor in. Michael Thomas, who's a great locker room leader and good special teams guy, but didn't really factor in on the defensive side of the ball. And outside of that, you know, it's a bunch of guys that you would look at the piece of paper and be like, okay, you know, whatever. They didn't really lose much, which, again, speaks volumes about the personnel right. that they had in the first place.
It reminds me of when the Cardinals, after 2018, they lost a lot of players, but it's not like they were impact players.
Exactly.
They tried to get every bit of stink off of the 2018 mm-hmm. season mm-hmm. before last year.
And that's kind of how it felt this year because, you know, you're looking at the players lost and, honestly, I wonder how that'll factor into the compensatory pick formula later on, but you know, that's down the line. But really, they didn't lose much. I mean, Manning retiring honestly sent a ripple effect throughout the area, throughout the organization, things like that. That's a long story. It's a successful career that you have to say goodbye to in what feels like a blink of an eye. And obviously, that will be felt. But I think the presence of Daniel Jones helps ease those concerns for obvious reasons. As far as the players coming in via free agency, it was a lot of patchwork stuff. Like Blake Martinez is a good example at middle linebacker, one of the inside linebacker spots. A good quality tackling machine of a linebacker, which the Giants haven't actually had for quite some time now. But again, he doesn't fix the problems that have persisted with this defense over the last decade or so, which, you know, covering the tight end is an absolute nightmare for this team. And unfortunately, players like Blake Martinez are not going to come in and immediately fix that. So it's going to be a continued issue that they're going to have to work on. I do like the addition of running back Deion Lewis. However, I think the Giants were really lacking a strong backup to Saquon Barkley. I think it was one of their weakest areas. He's not, you know, necessarily a superstar, but he's proven the ability in a committee kind of style of format that he could come in and be successful. He can block, you know, he could pick up the blitz, he could pass protect, he can, you know, make plays out of the backfield. He could carry the ball should Barkley get hurt, which we saw, you know, unfortunately last year. He is human after all. So it's entirely possible that he has to come in and play some reps. And I feel much more comfortable with him than I had Wayne Gallman or John Hilliman or some of the other players deeper on the Giants roster. And then, of course, you know, they swing tackle Cam Fleming, you know, which is helpful. They kind of lacked that versatility last year, and that's part of the whole, you know, rebuild the offensive line project. And again, then when you look at the draft, you have Andrew Thomas coming in, who I expect to start at right tackle as opposed to left tackle. He immediately shores up one of those tackle positions, which, you know, like the backup running back, like some of the other positions like middle linebacker, the Giants have really, really had a problem with in recent years. And the hope being, of course, that Nate Solder can kind of bounce back and stay on that left side for at least another year, allow Andrew Thomas, you know, to get his feet under him and not have that pressure of protecting Daniel Jones's blind side. But I think he's going to factor in. Xavier McKinney is the safety they took. I think he's going to step in and start next to Jabril Peppers immediately. He's kind of capable of playing both safety positions, but I think he's better center fielding safety, which allows Peppers to play a little bit closer to the line of scrimmage and be kind of the hard-hitting, strong safety that he's really built to be. And you know, other than that, there was a lot of depth additions. The Giants, as we touched on multiple times already today, they've been lacking personnel. They're still lacking personnel. So those depth signings, although they don't, you know, they're not flashy, they're not going to get the big headlines, it's sort of what this team needs. They've got this young talent at the front of their roster, but then behind it, it gets really thin, really, really thin the farther down you go.
Well, good. So now, knowing what you know about what last year was, the additions they made this year, what are the expectations for 2020? You've got a division where pretty much everyone thinks it's a two-horse race there with the Cowboys and the Eagles. What are your expectations in terms of the Giants? What's your floor for them? What's your ceiling for them in terms of wins? And how do you see them matching up with the Cardinals? Obviously, we don't have to talk like game predictions, but how does that matchup look right now?
Well, the Giants were already a little bit behind the Cardinals last year, as we saw in that game. I think it was 4 or 5 point win by the Cardinals, something like that. And, you know, the Giants just seemed to step behind then. With a whole other year for the Cardinals under that system, having had that chance to develop, you know, they obviously what they get, DeAndre Hopkins.
Yes.
They've got Kenyon Drake, who I actually really feel is one of the more underrated players in the NFL. I think the Giants don't really match. And then you got Isaiah Simmons, too, on the defensive side of the ball, right? And I just don't think the Giants right now, I don't think they match up very well against the Cardinals. They were a little bit behind where the Cardinals were development-wise last year. I think that gap is only going to get larger this year. As far as the Giants themselves, though, over a 16-game span, it's difficult to predict just because it's a first-year head coach, a brand-new coaching staff, two new you know, systems. You've got all these new players. I think that's difficult enough to overcome for any team as it is. You throw in the bizarre nature of this offseason, the complete lack of the offseason. And I think the Giants, unfortunately, as a result of that, are going to be a little bit behind where the team normally would be as far as their development. I want to be optimistic. I desperately want to be optimistic, but I really would not put them even at an 8-8 at this point. I think maybe 7-9 would be the ceiling for this team. And I think even that might be a little pie in the sky. I could see them finishing as poorly as 4-12, but I'm sort of hoping that maybe they get back to that 6-10 mark where they pick up a couple unexpected early season wins. And then they finish out a little bit stronger with the easier portion of their schedule towards the end.
And so basically the goal right now is beat the Redskins in the division.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Don't, or whatever their name ends up being.
That's right. Just, that's like the Washington team.
The Washington team. Just beat the Washington team. You got to win those two. And I'll tell you what, if they even win one game against the Eagles, I will be satisfied with that because we've been taken in the rear end from the Eagles for way, way too long at this point.
Well, the Cardinals and the Giants have a long, in fact, I was going through their history, the Cardinals of the Giants, the Giants are the team that the Cardinals have played the most in their franchise history.
People forget that. People forget that.
That's comes from being two very old teams and then playing in the same division for a long time. Yep. Well, and then playing a couple of years in a row like this. But great. So we have two young teams, prom young quarterbacks. Teams. Yep. It's going to be an exciting year for both teams to look forward to. The Cardinals, we are hoping that they can crack the postseason. And the Giants, it looks like they're about a year, but they're kind of in the same spot as the Cardinals were this past year. But looking forward to the matchup. Dan, thanks for coming on. You can find his work at GiantsWire.com. He's not on social media, so you have to go to the site for that. Coming up next on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We will conclude our opponent preview with the Cardinals' final new opponent they will face in 2020, and that is the Philadelphia Eagles. That's right, another team, another opponent, and another guest to preview that game. That's coming up next on Rise Up Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. And now we're going to talk about the Philadelphia Eagles, a team the Cardinals don't play until December, one of their final home games of the year. But to give us some insight as to what we can expect from the Eagles this season, and so we can know a little bit more about what happened with them in over the course of the last year, I've invited the Eagles Wires, Glenn Irby, managing editor over at the Eagles Wire, part of the USA Today network of sites like Cards Wire. And he has graciously given me some time to tell us about what we should know about the Eagles, their offseason, and moving forward. Glenn, thanks for coming on the show. I really appreciate how you're doing.
Thanks for having me, Jess. How's everything going?
Everything is blazing hot over here where I live. We've been having 110 plus temperatures for like about the last week and a half. It's going to drop down to about 100 here by the end of the week, though.
Couldn't imagine. We just hope to get over 85, 90 some days.
I do. We always say that it's a dry heat, so there's that. But I do know that the back east, that the humidity is different. So I don't know which one I'd rather, but I've lived here my whole life, so I don't mind it. It's just hot. We have air conditioning for that thing.
I think I prefer the dry heat over the humidity.
Well, good stuff. So Glenn, tell us about the Eagles last season. Obviously, they were in the NFC East. Pretty much everyone except, well, between the Cowboys and the Eagles, it was kind of a toss-up to how that was going to go. Tell us how your thoughts of last season, how they did, how it went compared to expectations.
The expectations were there. I mean, I think considering how everything went with the injuries and different things like that, and the ability to win the four games down the stretch and finally get the Cowboys off their back. I mean, it was a big season. 9-7 is not 10-6 or 11-5, but considering you lose DeSean Jackson, you lose Alshon Jeffrey, you lose a bunch of other guys. You finally get Carson Wentz, you know, to play a full season, so he gets that off his back. I understand he didn't finish the playoff game, but he started 16 games. He showed his leadership, his arm strength, different things like that. So for some, it could have been a disappointing season, but considering they made the playoffs for the third straight year, showed that they have an elite quarterback, got some young guys, some experience, it was a pretty good year.
Awesome. So we look to the offseason. Let's talk. Who were the impact losses to the team in free agency? How's that going to affect him? And who have they added in free agency and in the draft that should make an impact coming into this season?
I think up until 2 days ago, probably the biggest impact loss was Jason Peters, and you see we got him back to play right guard. So I think, you know, the biggest loss would probably be Brandon Brooks, you know, tearing his Achilles again, you know, the best right guard in football, one of the best linemen or football players in an NFL period. So that's a huge loss, but getting Peters back is big. Nigel Bradham's loss at middle linebacker, will probably have to wait and see until the season starts. You know, they have some good young guys there. They brought in Jatavis Brown from the Chargers. So the linebacker position is a bit iffy, but I think the biggest, you know, acquisitions have to be, you know, Darius Slay, Hargrave, and Nicole Roby Coleman. And they don't have to be in any of the three orders. I think you have a game record, a defensive tackle. You finally have a solid, you know, solidified cornerback with name recognition. And Roby Coleman in the slot is going to be a big move that'll probably go under the radar until maybe midseason. But that's a huge move in itself. So definitely on the defensive side of the ball, those three additions are huge.
So, question on Peters. How, obviously, the career that he's had, how tough do you think the adjustment will be for him to kick inside and not only play inside, but on the opposite side of the line?
I mean, he has great feet. He's one of the most athletic linemen I've ever seen. So I think from a physicality standpoint, that'll be where it could be tough. You know, he's 38. He's played several years in the league. He's going to take more of a banging inside than he did outside at left tackle. So that's where it'll come in. But I think from just an athletic, you know, athletic standpoint, he's huge. He's a big man. So he's not going to fall off from a size standpoint. So I just think from the beating that he'll take, you know, inside, it'll be interesting to see. But at the worst, you have a guy, you know, who can slide to left tackle if Dillard struggles, continue to mentor Dillard, and mentor the other guys around him. So I think it's a huge move. And if you can't play right guard, Pryor or someone else can.
All right. So obviously the additions in the back end were critical. That was Philly's kind of the biggest weakness. Well, by the end of last year, wasn't it the lack of receivers and the lack of coverage? But adding Slay, adding Roby Coleman, those are very good additions. How do you think that will impact the defense overall?
I mean, I think it's huge from a confidence standpoint. I think Slay brings a confidence. I think he brings an attitude, a swagger, as they say. Roby Coleman as well. I think it will allow Jim Schwartz, who likes to do different things, to, you know, maybe blitz a little more, but definitely feel comfortable about what he's doing. We now have a guy, so when we play the Cowboys or the Redskins with McLaurin, you have a guy that you could put on another team's number one, and it takes the pressure off of Sidney Jones and guys like Avonte Maddox and Rasul Douglas and the guys that maybe shouldn't be lined up with another guy's number one. So you have Slay on the number one. A lot of teams' best players sometimes go in slot. You have Roby Coleman there as well. So that idea of guys just, you know, pitching and catching on the Eagles and 50-yard bombs here and big plays there, I think they disappear. So as we talk about the Eagles' lack of pass rush in certain instances, the ability to add Slay and Roby Coleman maybe helps the pass rush, you know, as from an extent.
And Cardinals fans are quite familiar with difficulty in the back end of the defense dealing with last year when Patrick Peterson suspended for the first six games and then what didn't look like himself up until December.
Right.
Robert Alford getting breaking his leg in training camp. And so, you know, when you talk about a bad pass defense, the Cardinals had that at the top of their list, considering they gave up an average quarterback rating of, I think, 109 last year. So basically, on average, every single quarterback was a Hall of Famer against them. So because right. 109, that's like above Hall of Fame level.
Definitely. And that's with Chandler Jones as a pass rusher.
Right.
So you see what, you know, having good guys in the back can do.
What else are kind of the stories of the offseason? Obviously, it doesn't come as good news, things that DeSean Jackson had said. I think things are kind of tiding over with that. But are there any other offseason issues that are kind of hanging over the Eagles, good or bad?
not really bad. I think that was the first negative moment of the offseason. I think, you know, you've had discussions about Peters coming back and different things like that. So he's back, you understand. I think up until maybe week one, you'll have discussions about, you know, whether Clowney wants to be here or other top free agents. But I think at this point, it's just about trying to, you know, you won't be able to do that till you get on the field, but trying to integrate all that speed you brought over, you know, with Marquise Goodwin and the three draft picks at receiver. So I think, you know, the defense will be fine. I think they'll be fine from the gate. I think they'll probably be the best part of both units. But I think just quietly trying to get this offense situated, quietly trying to figure out where Jalen Hurts fits as a quarterback or as a gadget player, quietly trying to figure out, you know, Preston Taylor's role and Rich Gangarello's role in the offense and, you know, helping Carson Wentz. I think it's just been a quiet offseason besides Deshaun, but it's just more about, you know, integrating the pieces on offense and seeing what happens.
So Carson Wentz. Is he, do you see him as their long-term answer at quarterback? Obviously, when healthy, he's been pretty fantastic. It was really unfortunate for him and his, like, in his legacy, I mean, legacy at this point of his career, to have Nick Foles lead them to the championship instead of him. Can you count, do you think Eagles fans and the franchise is ready to have him to be the guy they count on moving forward?
I think so, without a doubt. I mean, he's a top passer. I think you have to get past, you know, the woe is me feeling that the city has with its athletes at times. And, you know, you go back and forth and you argue, if you put Carson Wentz on a lot of other teams, maybe not the Cardinals, but a lot of other franchises and a lot of other cities would take Carson Wentz today and give you half their roster for him. So it's only here in Philadelphia that you go through the whole, you know, is it Nick Foles? Should we have kept Carson Wentz? Carson Wentz is a top five quarterback. We believe he showed that the last 5 or 6 weeks of the season last year. It's just about, you know, once we get past the whole injury thing and finishing seasons and being injury prone, if you talk to someone from Philadelphia or you talk to someone about Wentz and you ask the wrong person, they'll make you think he missed 32 games when he's missed 8 games his whole career.
Right.
So
right,
it's the weirdest obsession. I mean, he's a baller. You've seen the throw he made against the Redskins when he hit Ward in the back corner of the end zone. Just throws like that. The throw he made to Sanders, he can make throws. He can escape the pocket. He's a huge presence. He's a great leader. We just get caught up in so much weird conversation and so many weird takes, you know, between him and Dak Prescott and everyone else. But he's the man, and I think 28 other cities, 25 other cities would take him in a heartbeat.
Nice. So let's look ahead to the coming season, 2020. What are your expectations for the team? What do you think their best case and worst case scenario is? And how do you think they match up against the Cardinals? Obviously, the two teams probably will look quite different by the time December rolls around for how the NFL season goes, but on paper, how do you think they match up against each other, and what are you expecting from Philly this year?
In terms of the Cardinals, I think prior to Slay and Roby Coleman coming over, that would have been a rough one. I mean, in terms of, you know, Larry Fitzgerald, I think he would have had a big game. We know Hopkins would have had a big game. Kenyon Drake would have had a big game. I think with the additions, it turns into a really, really good late season game that should probably get flexed to put on national TV. You have two top-notch quarterbacks. Both running backs are really good. The receivers are now really good. You guys' defense just got better. We'll see, you know, how Isaiah Simmons fits. But, you know, he fits well. You already have Chandler Jones, Devondre Campbell, Jordan Hicks, a former Eagle, how that'll play. So that'll be a great matchup. But I think in terms of worst-case scenario for the Eagles, I think similar to last season, anything less than 9-7 is really a disappointment, or Carson Wentz got hurt or something disastrous happened. I think the best-case scenario for the team, 11-12 wins, playoff spot, probably, you know, fighting for the Cowboys for another division title. But I see both teams getting in the playoffs, especially with the added playoff slot. And the sky's the limit for the team.
That's fantastic. One of the I'm looking forward to hoping that the Cardinals are as good as I hope they can be, and that
I think they'll be excellent.
That will be a premier matchup late in the year. It's not Cowboys Eagles, because everyone knows that that that's supposed to be on television for everyone, even though we hate the Cowboys here and we really don't enjoy, as Arizona, we don't enjoy watching those NFC East matchups. They bring back some bad memories. Like, I'm old enough to remember when the Cardinals were in the NFC East.
Definitely.
And personally, I wish that the Buddy Ryan era didn't exist for the Cardinals. And I always equate him with the Eagles. So,
but yeah, that's it. But I mean, you guys have a great young team. Great. I love the quarterback. So I expect play like the best division in football, in my personal opinion. I mean, between you guys, Seahawks, 49ers, like, you could actually have the whole division in the playoffs.
That'll be tough to do, but yeah, the math is there. That'd be fantastic. Appreciate your time, Glenn. Listeners, that is theeagleswire.com. Don't forget the D, because otherwise you'll end up at some other Eagles site. But go to theeagleswire.com, theeagleswire.usatoday.com. And Glenn, can my listeners find you on social media if they want to engage in any discussion about Philly?
Definitely. They can go on Twitter. You can follow the Eagles Wire with the, or you can follow me on social media at the Cover 2. So that'd be THACOVER2. And appreciate you having me on, and look forward to talking to you more as the season progresses.
Thanks, Glenn, so much for your time. And with that, Cardinals fans, we have reached the end of episode 274 of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We will be back in a week, back with Seth, back on the microphone, and we will talk about training camp and all the important news that's coming up as we get ready for the coming season. Thanks, Cardinals, for listening. Thank Cardinals fans for listening, and we will be back in a week. Go Cardinals. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms, so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up Sea Red.
Rise up!
Sea Red!
Rise!